Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Every day.
Here's John Williams.
What we do for you. Mm-hmm. Not to say you don't do it yourself, but I got some in my mind. We'd like to share them with you weekdays from 1 to 3. And on Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 12 noon. This is John Williams. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio. We are 18 stories above the Chicago River. Beautiful downtown Chicago. We see the buildings. We see the pretty sky today and the lovely Lake Michigan. It's good to be here. Remember, on social media, you can find us at WGN King John on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram. WGN King John is me, John Williams. We won't get into it today. Just a couple of postscripts from yesterday's show, and then we'll move on to our first conversation with Jane Kirtley, who is an ethics and media expert. We'll talk about Alex Jones and should he be banned from Twitter. Of course he should. Twitter is tying themselves in knots trying to explain why they are not going to kick them off the platform. And I think they're making a huge mistake. We'll talk to Jane about that and get your opinion on it, too. In fact, our news click today at WGNradio.com, our daily web poll question and our Facebook post is asking you that. Should Twitter ban Alex Jones like YouTube and Facebook have? Also on my Facebook page, we have the results from we have a post on my Facebook page about songs that should be made into TV shows or movies. And one of them, the reason we're even talking about this, is the Plain White Tees.
Hey there, Delilah, what's it like in New York City? I'm 1,000 miles away, but girl, tonight you look so pretty. Yes, you do.
Remember this song? Isn't this a fun song?
Times Square can shine as bright as you.
When's the last time you heard this song?
I swear it's true.
All the way through. Sing it home.
Hey there, Delilah, don't you worry about the distance. I'm right there. If you get lonely, give this song another listen. Close your eyes.
We got to stay around for the hook now, don't we? We can't bail on this, right?
Do we?
Here we go.
Oh, what you do to me?
Come on, sing it home.
Oh, what you do to me? Oh,
all right, cut it.
Really, you guys, you're just saying that because that makes you feel smart and powerful. But you know you love that song, in your soul, you're going, "Oh, this is so much fun."
I don't know that I do. I actually don't know exactly how I feel about it. It's too late to have, like, an unbiased, objective, like, is this a good or bad song? I have no idea.
It's, like, annoying because you have to sing it. If it's on, yeah. It's going to stay on. But it's not like I'm like, hey, you know what song I'm going to look up? Hey There, Delilah.
I think a fair... fair enough.
It's certainly not like I hear it and I say to myself, I would like a 10-episode series about the world of this song, which is what we're getting, apparently.
That's the mystery of it. I mean, okay, it's a fun song. I like it, and you guys do. You just can't admit it. That's fine, but now does it need to be? How does that become a 10-episode TV series? So on Facebook, I said, okay, they're going to do that. What other songs do you think would be great movies or great TV shows? And if you think about it, how has that not been tapped? It has, but not that richly. There are not that many great movies or TV shows that are based on popular songs. It's a good idea, but it hasn't happened.
Well, it's sort of like the logical conclusion of the race for intellectual property that's going on in movies and TV, which is like everything has to be based on something else. So we've done all the books. We've rebooted every movie.
We've done SNL skits.
We've certainly done that. We've brought back old TV shows. I mean, they're in the middle of doing that with every old show. So now they're moving to songs. Yeah.
But there's some equity there. Like, if you like this song, oh, you're going to love this show. So for me, yesterday, remember, it was The Decemberists. The Sporting Life tells the story of a young man who does badly on the playing field, disappoints his dad, his coach, his school, and his girlfriend is now on the arm of the captain of the other team. I thought, ooh, that would be a good one.
Yeah, and I mean, in the 2000s, music videos were huge. So there was almost like a mini movie inside all of these songs.
Exactly.
And that's not really a thing anymore.
It doesn't seem to be as resonant or as important. I mean, there have been some examples, right? Like
I remember when the Roses video came out by Outkast. That was a huge deal. And that was kind of a mini movie. Yeah. And then they made their own movie called Idlewild and put it out with an album called Idlewild. That, I feel like they could have been on this. If the times were just a little different, they would have had a TV show based on an album or song.
I looked at hits of the 90s and 80s. Those songs didn't strike me as great opportunities. But when I got to the 70s, you Google around and you go, oh, wow, here's some fun songs that seem to tell stories. They just aren't about sex, angst, and love. And so anyway, we're asking you on Facebook to follow along and tell us what you would like to see made into a TV show or movie on my Facebook page.
Has anyone said The Streak yet?
There are some single one-offs. You know another example, Steve? I mean, so The Streak, funny song, and okay, that'd be a silly funny movie or TV show or episode. Alice's Restaurant.
Yeah.
That has been made into a movie, but evidently not a great enough movie that I ever remember seeing it. So I want a song that was fun, that told a story that you love, that you'd love to see be made into a movie that hopefully would be decent, because that has not happened a lot. Also on my Facebook page, I posted a link to another Facebook page that I host, and that's my trip to France next year. If you're going with us to France, Brenda and I, via Kelly Cruises, make sure you like me on Facebook, and you'll see the link to the other Facebook page or post there. And if you're not going with us, there are about 15 cabins left on our trip to France. We'll be in Paris and Normandy on the 75th anniversary of the D-Day landing. It's going to be a great trip, and we've got a Facebook page dedicated to it. I'm WGN King John on Facebook. Should Alex Jones be banned from Twitter next?
It's everywhere that I supposedly death threatened and said that I was going to shoot Robert Mueller. Let me set the record straight 100%. A, I don't want to turn Robert Mueller into a martyr. I don't want Hillary to be hurt, Obama, Michael Moore, any of these people. We're ideologically beating them fair and square with our ideas. B, I don't want to go to prison.
That's Alex Jones, doesn't want to go to jail, and is denying what he essentially did, which is kind of his M.O. He'll say 9/11 was an inside job, then back off. He'll say Sandy Hook was performed by fake actors, or Parkland was performed by fake actors, and then back off. And now he's saying that he didn't say that we ought to take Mueller out, although he essentially intimated that pretty directly on his show. A couple million people follow him. Facebook, YouTube, sites like that have said we're not going to host his channels, but Twitter continues to host him. And here's part of CEO Jack Dorsey's statement. He said, we did not suspend Alex Jones. He has not violated our rules, and we'll continue to promote a healthy conversational environment by ensuring tweets aren't artificially amplified. So they'll make sure that they're not artificially amplified, but they're not going to be the diviner of truth of tweets. They don't want to get into that. In fact, he said, this is Jack Dorsey again, if we succumb and simply react to outside pressure rather than straightforward principles, we become a service that's constructed by our personal views that can swing in any direction, and that's not us. So they're going to be a free-form platform, and Twitter does seem to be the platform these days, Instagram notwithstanding. Think how President Trump pushes Twitter. That's where it's happening for a lot of folks, and if Alex Jones wants to use it and say the stuff he says, they will support that, which to me is also an endorsement of that. Jane Kirtley joins us now. She's the director of the Scylla Center at the University of Minnesota, a legal and an ethics expert on the media. Hey, Jane, you're on WGN again. Welcome back.
Hi, John.
I know you're at a conference. Are you talking about something like this, or is it a different topic?
No, it's interesting that we're talking about this because we were having a discussion about incendiary tweets and speeches and remarks at things like Trump's rallies where he encourages people to take care of protesters. So, you know, this is the issue du jour.
And what do you make of the Alex Jones controversy today? Should these platforms be pulling him down, or in the name of unfettered free speech in America, should they leave him up and let us decide?
Well, let me state the obvious, which is that these are private entities. They are not governmental entities, and so they are not subject to the First Amendment, and they can, you know, it's their playground, it's their rules, and they can decide when they're going to toss people overboard and when they're going to keep them on board. The critical question is always, are their terms of service clear, and sometimes they're not very clear, about what the criteria would be for eliminating people, especially if they're not engaged in speech that is clearly not protected by the First Amendment, like obscenity, for example. I think Twitter is kind of trying to have it both ways. They're trying to depict themselves as this freewheeling, free-formed organization that just encourages freedom of speech. And, you know, I take them at their word where they say they don't want to be affected by a public outcry if it doesn't agree with their standards. But I guess my questions are exactly what are their standards? And I think that's what people are thinking about. And I'm sure many people immediately thought when they saw that, oh, what they're really doing is making sure that nobody's going to be able to point to them and say that they should be kicking Trump off of Twitter, because that, of course, would be, I think, pretty disastrous for them.
Do you think that, so you do not think they should censor or cherry-pick Trump's tweets? You would continue to let Donald Trump do what he does on Twitter, right?
I would if I'm Twitter, because that would allow me the at least plausible deniability of saying I'm not a viewpoint-based outlet, I don't have an editorial viewpoint. As long as he's not violating our terms of service or breaking the law, let him have at it. And
Alex,
I think that, frankly, is the position they have to take.
Sure, but Alex Jones is a different animal than Donald Trump, right?
Well, you know, I suppose the jury could be out on that. I mean, he's obviously not president of the United States, but it hasn't been the case that President Trump has not on occasion made a factual statement that is proven to be false and then rolled it back. So in that sense, there's a similarity. I think Alex Jones is clearly a lot more incendiary and I would say a lot more delusional. But that, again, I suppose is a matter of opinion.
So what would you do with Alex Jones if you were Twitter?
I think as long as they can, with a clear heart, say he has not violated our terms of service, I think you leave him on there. The question here is, I mean, there are a couple of issues, and I'll just be brief. I think one is sort of the hate speech and incendiary nature of his discourse, that kind of stuff, and then the issue of spreading disinformation. Those are, I would argue, distinct things. Hate speech is loathsome, but ultimately we're talking about matters of opinion. Political opinion enjoys the highest protection under the First Amendment. Promulgating falsehoods is very detrimental to society. We know that in this era of fake news. But on the other hand, the law doesn't create a mechanism to shut people down because they're telling lies. Unless the lies they tell, for example, hurt somebody's reputation, there is no remedy in law for that. So I think what we're left with is, do we want to turn Twitter, Facebook, Google, whoever, into the truth police? I know we don't want the government to do that, but are we more comfortable with private actors doing that, who themselves have sometimes been a little truth challenged about their own activities? That's the rub, that you protect this speech that many people find appalling for fear of stifling other speech that would be legitimate.
Well, the speech is protected. Nobody's saying Alex Jones can't say hateful things, but if I'm a private company, I don't have to let him say it on my place, and I don't have to justify it. If I don't like the fact
absolutely
that you're left...
Absolutely true. No, I agree with you, and I said that, I think, at the outside. That these private companies have absolutely no obligation to allow anybody
to be
on board, and they can...
Well, I'm not real tight up. I'm disappointed in you, Jane. I mean, you and I think, operate under the same principles, and I see how, I get the logic of what you're saying. But since a private company can do whatever it wants, I don't think they have to justify it beyond you're hateful and not telling the truth. And while maybe some people will get away with it, you're not, because you have 2 million followers and we don't like you and you're off the platform. And you all can cry
that. Can I be lawyerly here and say that the question is really going to be, what do their terms of service say? If they've drafted terms of service that say we can kick anybody off for any reason or no reason, then I'm absolutely with you that is something they can do and they can stand by that. Now, they're going to leave themselves vulnerable to criticism for that, but hey, if you're going to become a publisher as opposed to just a conduit, then that goes with the territory. I think the problem for so many of these companies is that they don't know what they want to be. They want to have all the protections that publishers would have, and yet by the same token, they also want to have the plausible deniability of saying, oh, I'm just a conduit. I don't make these decisions.
Right.
I mean, there's going to come a point where they can't have it both ways, and maybe Alex Jones is going to be the catalyst for some serious consideration.
Maybe they need to rewrite the terms and re-sign everybody up. I think what they want to be is profitable. So do they want to be a publisher, or do they want to be the mailman? Do they want to be utility? Those are two separate entities, right? You don't blame the mailman for the hate speech that comes in the mail. You do blame a publisher for publishing a hateful book because they knew and didn't have to do that.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
Okay, but what they mostly want to be is profitable. And I just think Twitter is looking greedy and dumb here. I think they're looking short-sighted. And you're right, if their hands are tied because of the terms of service, then I think they need to fix that yesterday. But mostly I think they're just thinking, you know what? Twitter is the topic right now, and they're acting like it's good for them. And I use Twitter. Our station uses Twitter. I use it as I put things out, and I also gather a lot of information from Twitter. It's invaluable, but I'm mad at that platform right now, Jane. I think they're making a decision that is easy to make right, and they're finding a tortured maid to come up with the wrong decision.
Well, the thing is, I think, again, as you're suggesting, their motive is profit, and they want to have it both ways. They want to be able to retain this attention and to create this buzz.
Yep.
And they know that if they kick off somebody like Alex Jones, the next question is going to be, why are you allowing Trump to continue to do sort of his version of Alex Jones light? And I'm sure they don't want to grapple with that question.
Well, and maybe they will have to, but get a load of this. When I get to be king, Jane, did you know I want to be king someday?
I say that to my students all the time. If you were king, what would the law be? So I think that's a great exercise.
All right, and so when I'm the king and I have power and it's sort of unilateral, I'm just going to say Jones is on, Trump is off. I don't like Trump stuff either, but Trump is on Jones. And I don't have to justify to you beyond that. And in fact, Jane, unless I'm violating my own terms, that's true, right?
That is true. And it's just a question of whether you're comfortable taking the slings and arrows of people that are saying you're being a hypocrite, you're being a liberal, you're being a conservative, whatever it is. But as I said, if you're going to be a publisher, if you're going to play that role of tossing people overboard because what they're saying you don't approve of or you don't like, you've got to be prepared to take that heat. And I think the problem for so many of these companies is they've kind of come into this role of publishers through the back door. They didn't realize what a challenge this would really be.
Poor Mark Zuckerberg, not that he's Twitter, but I mean, there he was just saying, hey, let's do a thing that rates girls, and then, okay, let's be a fun social platform. And suddenly these guys have to grapple with these impossible social issues that I'm sure they did not anticipate when they first created these things, but that's the space they live in now, and that's what they have
to
resolve.
So, Jane, yeah, and my heart bleeds for them. they knew the job was dangerous when they took it, and I have no sympathy for them. But I wish they would get some good advice so that they would proceed in a way that would be principled and would make sense.
They should get it from me and Jane Curtley, although I'm not sure. So, Jane, I'm leaving you, Jane. But here's my question on our Facebook page and website: should Twitter ban Alex Jones, and the assumption there is that the law and the terms would allow them? My answer is yes. And if the terms allow them, your answer is?
I hate to get into the territory of saying ban this speaker, ban that speaker, because I just see it as such a slippery slope. What's key to me is what their terms of service say, and if their terms of service say they can get rid of Alex Jones, they can do it with my blessing, not that they need it.
That's Jane Curtley at the University of Minnesota's Silla Center. She's a professor of media ethics and law, can you tell? Nice to talk to you, Jane.
Oh, it's a pleasure, John.
You are. It's 128 on W. Phil Patel normally joins us at this time. Phil may be strolling in here shortly. Hey, Phil, where are you? You remember this time yesterday? I'm sure you do. We were talking about styrofoam cups versus ceramic mugs.
Yes, yes.
We had a real smart science writer from the New York Times, and he said that a lot of the recycling we do is quote-unquote garbage, pun intended. But he said a lot of the things that we're doing to protect the earth make us feel good about ourselves, but really don't do much good. Phil said he's on his way in. Okay, Griff, thanks. So anyway, it came down to this, Steve, among other things. A lot of you not believing in my belief in science or not believing his science reporting. And I'm one of those people who, if I think a doctor knows more about spleens than I do what the doctor says, even if he doesn't spleen it well to me. And I feel
that was not funny.
I feel the same way about, you know, a science writer. If he investigates it and goes, you know what, throwing away straws, plastic straws, and using paper straws, you know, paper straws are better than plastic. He said, that's not true. It takes more energy to produce paper straws. They don't disintegrate like you hope they will. And that less than 0.1% of the pollution in the ocean is caused by the United States. Pardon me, less than 1% is caused by the United States, and straws are a fraction of that. So he's like, we've all got straw religion, and it really doesn't matter. You know, if you really want to matter, let's pick something that matters. But this, like, oh, good, I'm helping the environment, is a fraud. And he says that especially about your feelings about styrofoam cups. Styrofoam cups take very little energy to make, and they crush up and don't take much space in a landfill. Meanwhile, you're walking around with a ceramic mug, feeling good about the environment, forgetting the fact that the washing of and the creation of that ceramic mug take a ton of energy. So you're better off with styrofoam cups than ceramic mugs. And then you say, yeah, but what if I use that ceramic mug 5,000 times? Well, then you win. But guess what, you don't. Oh, and by the way, you have two ceramic mugs.
So I made a point of bringing a recycling container in the studio there.
You're such a smarty pants.
Because we have a lot of papers. I particularly do have a lot of papers for the show, and
yeah.
I throw them in the recycling bin, and I pointed it out to you, and I said, you won't use it because it doesn't pay off.
That's not true.
Okay, but really, I wonder how much energy was used in deforming the plastic and dyeing it blue and creating that bucket, and how many pieces of paper we have to put in there
and
to
then
break even.
And then think about this just for a second.
With no help from you.
Wherever you live, you have a garbage truck that picks up your garbage, and then you have another great big garbage truck spewing fumes that's going to pick up the recycling. So now we have double the big trucks going up and down the road because we want to recycle. And if that makes sense, we should do it. But if it doesn't, we shouldn't. And we should be open to the notion that maybe what we're doing makes us feel good, but it's wrong.
Yeah, but it makes us feel good. And if we can't help the world anyway, we might as well feel good while we're here.
We're going to go the way of the dinosaurs. We're just going to be this hot, humid, super, you know, bad place. And
okay, here's the answer.
Okay.
Renewable energy.
Mm-hmm.
If we're using renewable energy,
right,
then the fuel caused that needed to heat the cup or to drive the truck won't have the same impact.
Solar, wind, and hydro. I'm all about it, unless you want to put one of those giant windmills on my farm field. But yeah, I think that's great.
Do you have a farm field?
No.
And isn't there a lot of grazing space that's going unused? You can put solar panels there instead of landfills.
Yeah. Here's the equation. Okay. Go ahead, Steve. I know there's something on your mind.
Well, I just said, but you've challenged Griffin, right, to find a scientist who sees it differently.
Yeah.
Has he had any luck, please?
Here's what we found. So this is interesting. The equation comes down to, if you just do ceramic mugs versus styrofoam cups, right? The question becomes, how many times do you have to use the ceramic mug to make it a better environmental option than a styrofoam cup?
Right.
And the numbers we found were between 20 and 3,000. So science isn't decided on this, a number that I'm comfortable with is 1,500. If you use your mug 1,500 times, then you're better off using that than if you are using styrofoam cups. Why are you putting your hands in your face, Violetta? What's the matter?
Because I don't know how you picked that number, and you and this one scientist are the only, I just don't know where you're getting, why did you settle on 1,500?
Okay, I shouldn't have settled on 1,500. But that's the problem. That's the problem.
Well, you got to figure out, there's so many variables, right? So every equation you're throwing in, you know, I would imagine a lot of those equations don't include the gas for the garbage truck. And if they do, probably not the energy required to make the garbage truck or,
How far back do you go? And how often do you wash it out? And how much hot water? And how hot is the water? And things like that. So those all start to matter.
Imagine all the energy we're using to think about this. My brain is emitting.
So at the end of the day, the super smart scientist who's committed his life and career to this, as opposed to you guys, he came up with three things that you should recycle. Paper, cardboard, aluminum cans. Paper, cardboard aluminum cans. But the glass that you're recycling, the plastic that you're recycling, is not a slam dunk. It's not a slam dunk. Okay, just wanted to kind of catch you up on that. We're still working on getting a scientist to pop all of the balloons that we floated the other day.
And again, the guest you talked to yesterday, who was very reasoned and persuasive, he was persuasive because he wasn't really trying to persuade, right?
He was just letting the numbers talk.
Right. But he's not a scientist. Isn't he a science writer?
Affirmative.
Okay. It's a little different.
John Tierney from the New York Times. And his piece was Recycling is Garbage. Okay, we'll pause here. Phil Vitale's somewhere around the building. We'll catch up with the food critic for the Chicago Tribune in a couple. His piece today is 50 places that he likes. They wrote about it in the print edition of the Chicago Tribune. They didn't post all 50. They did online. We'll walk through some of them. By the way, Steve Violetta, just so you know, here are some of the numbers that we came up with when we started looking into what's the right choice, the ceramic mug or the styrofoam cup, from a newsletter out of Stanford. When they asked, what's a responsible cup of coffee? They wrote, mugs hanging around your office tend to be used on average 50 times. You need to use it 150 times in order to justify that over a styrofoam cup. The Institute for Life Cycle Energy Analysis said you need to use your ceramic mug 1,006 times.
Well, those numbers vary very much.
Bucknell University said unless your ceramic cup lasts for 1,000 uses and you wash it only after every third use, is it justified? If you wash it every time, then figure 3,000 uses. And this from Trinity College in Dublin. They said you need to use the ceramic mug 25 times.
Well, I think we're getting somewhere.
I don't.
Well, I have a metal cup, you know, like a sippy cup for my coffee.
Yeah.
Thermos, I don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I only wash that once every couple weeks.
Yeah. You know, it depends on if your wife knows what it looks like in there, because right. A lot of us just kind of clean out the big parts and keep going.
If you only take the lid off to put more coffee in, then it doesn't matter.
Seriously, I think the hot
the hot coffee scrubs it.
That's what I do, Steve. Oh. That's how I justify it. I go, I'm boiling very hot coffee into this moldy cup. Well, the hot coffee's going to kill the mold. I don't need to rinse it out.
Absolutely. I think that's true.
Phil Vitale writes about restaurants for the Chicago Tribune. He just strolled into our studio. Hey, buddy, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
I'm sorry about the delay. You were caught downstairs.
I foolishly forgot my pass, and so...
This is what has happened since 9/11. The world is so difficult now. In order to get into a building where they know you and you know them, if you don't have a thing, then you can't get in a building.
And if you're inside that building, you're very grateful for that. There's some mean people out there.
Okay, so you're an advocate of what just kept you from getting to the studio on time.
Yes.
I am not. In fact, literally yesterday, one of my colleagues was standing on this 18th floor outside the doors into our offices. She works here. She's twiddling her thumbs. She can't get in. Why? Because she didn't have her little fob. And I'm like, oh, this is so stupid. You disagree.
I understand the rationale for having it. And, you know, you're talking to someone who had one of his... The sister newspaper shot up just a month ago. So
well, I appreciate that, Phil. Yeah. I don't think about it in those terms. And in fact, we are doing a live shooter drill in this building tomorrow.
And we've had classes.
They're taking it very seriously, and I want to do that. But I just think sometimes we're not being rational about it at the same time.
Well, there's a cost. There's a price. We lose something in this.
This is what we lose. And it's when I guess I need to learn that lesson, that a little frustration is better than a loss of safety. Phil Vitale in the Tribune today said, okay, here are 50 spots, not the 50 best spots.
Right.
But 50 spots you wanted to champion for your summertime dining.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this looks good. I'm online. You guys did a really nice job of this today.
Thank you.
So let's just talk about a few of them, can we?
Yeah. Some of the new ones on the list that I especially am happy to have been able to put in there.
Number 40, Mordecai at Wrigley.
Mordecai, which I really, really like. Sky, S-K-Y, rather, down in Pilsen. Belmore, which I popped all the way to number 4 on the list because that's I love that restaurant so much. Nico Osteria, which I put back on the list after they changed chefs, and now they're back up to where I was hoping they would be. Barbie's K, that really cute place out west on Chicago Avenue that's just doing Spanish food and just having so much fun. It's like going to a party.
Spanish food's different than Mexican food, right?
Quite a bit.
And yet, it does seem to me like there's a lot of Mexican places on your list or in town these days. Would you agree with that? A lot of people feature that? I mean, I don't know that Chicago is known for it, but it seems to me like you're not hurting to find a decent Mexican spot in this town.
No, we have a very nice, sizable population of people who once lived in central Mexico, and that's informed a lot of our restaurants. And yeah, and you know, in the last generation, Mexican food has gone from being exotic to a really easy sell.
Yeah,
right. I used to, once upon a time, I had to explain to readers what cilantro was. You don't have to tell anybody in this city what cilantro is anymore.
They probably have some cilantro wedged between their teeth, even as you're talking to them.
I mean, Chipotle Grill, if they'd opened 25 years ago, you couldn't have pronounced it properly. Everybody would be Chipotle or whatever.
On your list, number 26, Everest. So you're not just doing dine-in dash out places. I mean, Everest is one of the finest restaurants in the city.
As I said, I'm trying to do a balance between places you can just walk in and afford and is fun, and also a number, but not all of them, of high-end fine dining.
But that's 26 on your list. 25 is also Girl and the Goat.
Right.
I have a $100 gift certificate to Girl.
Do you really?
I know. And I keep saying, Brenda, let's go to Girl and the Goat and use the certificate. She goes, that's not going to get it done. We will still need to spend a lot of money if we go to Girl and the Goat.
I disagree.
And I don't know.
I think you'll be, you'll spend a little bit more money, but you know, depending on what you want to be drinking. But no, it's mostly small plates, and it's I think it's very affordable. And
my problem
kind of control
that.
The price.
I get you, fair point. My problem too is I don't love the small plates concept, so maybe that's been the reason I haven't run out the door with that thing. And then 24 is Royster, Roister, the brash relative whom everybody loves.
Right, that's they're from the Alinea group. So on the high end of the family, you have Alinea, the rich uncle who does all these fabulous things and everything, the plating and the experience and what you have to do to eat the food, it's all very different. And Royster is one big open hearth, and almost everything is cooked there, and it's noisy and it's raucous, and the foods are the flavors are big and in your face. And yeah, so I called it the anti-Alinea once.
No. Which is a compliment, by the way.
I think they took it that way, yes.
Listening, that was the idea.
Yeah.
You also have North Pond on there, which I was glad to see.
Yeah, that's been so steady over the years, so great. Bruce Sherman was one of the prime movers and shakers that got us Green City Market, which is right in his backyard these days. And he probably doesn't get as much attention as he deserves.
Well, that was my point, too. I think there's some staples that we go, oh, yeah, I know about that place. I haven't been there in forever, or maybe never. And so let's give those guys their props, too. Phil Vitale's in the studio. He's the restaurant critic for the Chicago Tribune. In print today, you'll see the headline for his 50 spots he likes. Online, you'll find all of them. What else is a place that you want to highlight on the radio, Phil? What else do you like?
I really like, going back to places I've loved over the years, I have Momotaro up high on the list. I have Blackbird again. They're now 20 years old.
Where's Blackbird again?
Blackbird, 619 West Randolph Street. So it's just between Jefferson and Des Plaines on Randolph.
So they were on Randolph before everybody else was on Randolph.
They're on the other side. They're on the east side of the expressway too.
Oh.
So the real hot spot really started west of Halsted Street, where once upon a time, the only thing that was out there was Barney's Market Pub. And then Vivo and Marché came in, and they all of a sudden this became a hot area. And now restaurant square footage is more expensive in the Fulton Market area than it is in River North now. Who saw that coming?
Give me another one that we ought to be reminded of. They're still there. They're still swinging. They're still good. So try this restaurant.
Big Jones up in Andersonville. Paul Fairbach, after 10 years, just kind of put some more money in the place, redid it a little bit, really ramped up his kitchen, made a chef's counter area there. And he just does this great Southern food, but he goes deep into century-old cookbooks and pulls out these recipes. I mean, it's as much fun for me, the scholarship that goes into the food, as much as how tasty it is.
Is Topo Lombardo one of those standards that you like, speaking of Mexican fine dining?
Yes, they're so on the high end, I don't think anything Rick Bayless does will ever be off the radar. So you can say, oh, I forgot about Topo Lombardo. I don't think that's necessarily possible, but yes, it's the Mexican restaurant everyone should experience once. After you've done all the simpler Mexican restaurants, you sort of have built up to where now I'm ready to have a Mexican dinner that has no chips in it and doesn't have any guac in it and doesn't have any of the standards that you expect in other restaurants in it. Just great cuisine.
Of these 50, are some that you would recommend for August in Chicago, where we can, to me, the perfect spot, it's got the doors that open, so mm-hmm. that if it's cool and pleasant, you're sitting outside, or it feels like you're sitting outside. But if it's 98 degrees, they can close them and it's air conditioned.
Right.
I love, we want to do alfresco as much as we can,
right.
but sometimes you don't.
Right.
What's the best of these that are alfresco or nearly so?
Well, two of them. We just spoke about Royster, and their windows open up completely when the weather's nice.
Royster.
And then Tide House, which is sitting at 34, which is Debbie Gold's new place up in Lincoln Park. That place has windows that swing right open, and they also have a semi-covered outdoor area dominated by a huge stone fireplace. It's not necessarily lit all the time, but it's just a great little atmosphere. It's right next door to Shuba's Tavern, in fact, owned by the same people.
Yeah.
They took their old Harmony Grill, reduced it to rubble, and then built this thing from scratch.
Those huge doors are huge. They're not huge.
They're huge.
Yeah. You said huge. Huge. You said huge.
Yeah, I don't pronounce, I don't emphasize my H's properly.
Where are you from? Is that a geographic thing?
I don't know. I lived for 15 years in the Bronx. I don't know if it came from that, although that Trump is obviously a New Yorker, so maybe that's the UG thing we're talking about. But then I lived in Florida.
Repeat after me. Lake Michigan is a huge body of water.
Lake Michigan is a huge body of water.
See? You can do it.
I can do it.
Phil, we're out of time. It's always a pleasure to read you. Is there anything you want to promote that's coming up, or we'll just make sure we go online and see this?
Today's the first day of Food Bowl, and you can look up all those events at ctfoodbowl.com. Some of them are very inexpensive. Some of them are really rarefied. There are all kinds of things. There's a lovely dinner, cheese dinner going on at Bistronomic with two of the most heralded Midwestern cheese makers in town in the restaurant. So not only will you get cheese with each course, but the cheese maker will be there to explain what went into each cheese. That's
We've been
really
promoting
cool.
this for a month on this radio station.
Thank you.
Saying August. Well, look at the calendar, kids. It's time to go to ctfoodbowl.com and take advantage of some of the events and some of the specials that are going on in Chicago. Mm-hmm. All right, Phil, well done once again.
Thank you so much.
And I'll make sure that we have your name on the list.
Downstairs. I'll remember my silly card next time.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
And chips.
Here's John Williams.
Yep, big thoughts and also information about potato chips. This is John Williams. Lots of ground to cover in this hour. Remember, on social media, we are WGN King John on Insta, on Twitter, on Facebook. You'll find us there. Saturdays, we're on the air from 10 to noon. Our News Click question today is asking you if Alex Jones should be kicked off of Twitter. You can vote with your mouse. We'll report the results tomorrow. Yesterday, we asked you if the Chicago mayor should be limited to two terms. That's former Governor Pat Quinn's initiative. Quinn says, let's not let Rahm run for re-election. And 7 out of 10 of you are saying you're with Pat Quinn. We should limit the mayoral term to two terms. That's bad news for Rahm Emanuel. That will be on the ballot. And if 51% of the people in November say, yeah, then Rahm can't even run. Trust me, he's going to fight that legally. But that's what Quinn is trying to do. We posed that to you on our Facebook account and on our webpage. And 69% said, yes, limit the mayor to two terms. The News Click has a margin of error of plus or minus 100%. It is not a scientifically accurate survey. It's just folks sounding off that listen to WGN. So you know how this story goes, right? 74 people shot, 11, or are we up to 13 now, fatalities in Chicago over this past weekend. In a seven-hour period, early Sunday morning, 40 people were shot. At one point in Cook County, at Stroger, there were 200 people milling about. And at one point, my understanding is, at Mount Sinai, they actually, for a brief period of time, had to turn people away. Such was the carnage that they are still reporting nationally in Chicago over the weekend. Dr. Jaime Moreno is the Sinai Health System Medical Director and Chair of the Emergency Department. So he's in charge of the ER over there, and he joins us on WGN Radio. Doctor, it's John Williams. Thanks for giving us some of your time today. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Is that a correct assessment of what happened over the weekend and at Mount Sinai?
Yes, unfortunately, as you mentioned, it's been all over the news and made national headlines. It was a very, very tragic and violent weekend for Chicago, and a lot of our resources were overwhelmed, to be quite honest with you. It was that big of an uptick in violence.
Do you guys have any way of knowing, or do you figure it's Friday night, it's August, it's going to be busy? Do you have any clues coming in that day that it's going to be one day worse than another?
You know, that's a good question. You know, I think everybody knows and expects that in the summer there's just going to be more people out and about, out in the street. And I feel like energy levels just increase in the summer months when it's nice out. And unfortunately, in some of our communities, that energy level translates to violence. So, yes, not to sound callous, but sometimes when you see that it's nice outside, you expect to be busier in terms of trauma.
Can you describe for us some of the things that came through the door at your hospital over the weekend?
It was a number of things, and it's not only, you know, it's not only how many came in, but sometimes it's the amount that come in at once. So multiple, what we call GSWs, which are gunshot wounds. So, you know, some people might get shot in an arm or a leg, but other people get shot in multiple parts of their body. So, you know, every time you get a gunshot victim, the amount of times to assess each and every single patient, it takes a while. It takes a lot of, you know, you go through your protocols and try to, you know, assess everyone immediately and as carefully as you can. But you can imagine when you get four or five all together in a row, it tests the limits. But we had everything from gunshots to extremities to fatalities. So just a lot of victims altogether.
Do you have a number on how many total patients you saw over the weekend?
I don't have the exact number, but it was definitely over 20.
And when they come in, the people are usually conscious. I just wonder what the scene is like. They must be out of their mind in pain, or are they in a sense of shock, and so it's not as chaotic as I would imagine? You know, you can tell I've never been in the presence of somebody shot.
Sure.
So I wonder what that's like when here comes another one, here comes another one. Oh, my God, these would be events of my life, and you guys saw 20 of them in 72 hours. But just talk me through a little bit about what it is like when these people come in the door.
You know, every presentation is different, and every patient arrives, again, a lot of it depends on where they've been shot. A lot of it depends on how, you know, how bad the injury was. Some people do come in a state of shock, and that could be either described as an emotional shock or it could be described as a physiological shock. So these people come in, and they're alive. They might be awake, but they are just, in so many words, zoning in and out, right? And that's the physiological shot.
Yeah.
Other people are coming in, and you know, as you can imagine, they're in a great deal of pain. So, yeah, so those are, you know, in so many words, you hear them coming down the hallway. They're suffering. They're in a great deal of pain, and, you know, regardless, once we hear a gunshot wound, those patients take priority and they come straight back. But again, every presentation you can think of, we've seen.
Are the injuries pretty specific? That is, bullet goes in, bullet comes out, or is it more traumatic what you see?
Everything. There are people that have what we call flesh wounds or through and through wounds, and if they're lucky and they didn't have any major vessels such as a big artery or a big vein or a major fracture, right? When you get shot in an extremity, for example, you can fracture the bone. So some people are very fortunate. It goes through and through the muscle and it never hits a bone or a major vessel, and they actually walk out of the hospital the same day. Other people have worse injuries. As you can imagine, other people need to go straight to the operating room depending on their injury.
Yeah. And then is the challenge to figure out how great the damage is? I mean, there's a hole, but you really don't know what's happened to them, right?
Absolutely. And that's when a lot of your training and clinical knowledge comes into place. You have to make the call. Is this patient, in a steady state, where they can make it to a CAT scanner so we can take a better look at what's happening inside their body? Or do we think this is a life-threatening injury right now that we have to take this straight to the operating room? And to be honest with you, that's where we rely a lot on the trauma surgeons. And Mount Sinai I can't say enough about them. We have a fantastic group of trauma surgeons led by Dr. Vafa.
Well, I wanted to talk just a little bit about that. Dr. Jaime Moreno is on the phone. He's the director of emergency services over at Mount Sinai. It was one of the first spots that some of those victims over the weekend were taken. Let's hope we don't have another weekend like that, although every weekend, it sounds like, in the summer in Chicago is traumatic. But somebody in your business told me this is unfortunate and fortunate, but if you do it often enough, you get to be good at it. And they said at Mount Sinai and at Stroger, those people are pretty skilled at gunshot injuries. I guess that's what you're telling me, huh?
That's correct. They are very skilled. And again, I think you said it very well, fortunate or unfortunately. They just have a lot of experience with it. And when you have situations like that where they are chaotic and they test the limit, they're difficult to deal with, you always want to be surrounded by experienced people, and the trauma team at Mount Sinai is experienced, so they're excellent. I couldn't ask for a better team.
Dr. Moreno, where are you from?
Originally, I'm from Chicago.
Where'd you grow up? Where'd you go to school?
So I was born and raised in the near South Side in a neighborhood, a very nice neighborhood named Pilsen, which I'm very proud of. So I'm a Pilsen native, born and raised. I stayed local for university. I went to Northwestern up in Evanston, completed my medical school at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and I trained at Advocate Christ in Oak Lawn.
So you're a Southside guy through and through, aren't you?
Through and through.
And so, to some degree or another, you've been closer to this violence your whole life than a lot of us have, right?
Yes. Unfortunately, I've actually been touched by violence very, very personally. I've lost a brother to gang violence, so I know firsthand what it's like to lose somebody. I know what it's like to be surrounded and be in that kind of environment. I think I bring a slightly different perspective than many other of my colleagues.
Did that motivate you to want to go into this kind of medicine?
Yeah, it did. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And what do you say or want to say to the city or to the people on the South and West Side about this violence?
You know, I feel like I have a lot of thoughts on the matter, and I'm not a politician, and I'm not here to, I don't have an answer for world peace, or world hunger, but, I see a lot of what's going on in the news, and even people I personally come into contact with, and, things that I hear are, these communities should raise themselves up and take themselves out of the situation they're in. But, what I'd like to tell those people is if you're up to it, drive down to some of these communities and just drive through there and see what it feels like. Some of these communities, they're just driving through there. You get depressed and you feel like there's no hope. And, without somebody going in there and making a change and investing in those communities, I think everything we're doing are just small band-aids.
And you're the one putting the band-aids on. I mean, not only your personal history with this sort of violence, but professionally, you know, nobody is probably more frustrated than those of you who have to receive, you know, the mayor will cry and be frustrated. It's, you know, he loves the city and it's politically damaging to him, and nobody wants to see this happen, but none of us are on the receiving end of these bodies coming through the door. You and your staff are. It just seems to me like you would have a unique perspective on this, is all.
I do. And, you know, you can't take the time to speak to every single victim that comes through, but, you know, I'm not shy about sharing my story. I tell them how, you know, there are other ways and that, you know, you can change your life. You can lead another path regardless of how difficult it seems at that point in time in your life.
Well, this is not why I called, but I'll just share with you one observation that's been trickling through my head lately, because I say, well, the way to fix this violence in the city is we've got to find better ways to employ these people, because I think that's one of the, if there are many, root causes of this. But until then, I think, mothers, where are your children? Mothers, how are you raising your children? Fathers, why aren't you on your children's lives? But it really is these people, these parents, who have to do more to safeguard their children, either from being the victims or from being the trigger pullers. It's on them. That's what I've been thinking and feeling the last 2 days. What do you think about that, Doctor?
I think it goes even deeper than that. When we say these parents, you have to remember these parents were children that grew up exactly like this.
Yeah.
So this transcends generations. It's, you know, again, I'm not here to be a politician or speak politically on the matter, but I just think they're, you know, it's getting more police officers out there, unfortunately, puts police officers at, you know, their lives in danger as well. So I think to really get to the root of it, we just need to invest in these communities. You know, this is our city. I'm a proud Chicagoan. This is our city. When we see our city, we should include everybody.
Please share with your staff our appreciation for what they're doing. I'm sure that they are, however used to this, somewhat traumatized after this weekend, seeing 11-year-olds come through your doors and 60-year-olds come through your doors. But know that we are all rooting for you guys and hope that you don't have another weekend like this, sir.
Thank you. I hope the same. Thank you very much.
Doc, come into our studio sometime. Let's visit again, okay?
Will do.
Thank you, sir. He is the chief of emergency services over at Mount Sinai, Dr. Jaime Moreno. It's 2:22. This is WGN. Today would have been a better day for me to ride my bike to work.
You looked a little sweaty yesterday.
Yesterday, I forgot to kind of rinse off after I got to work, but I thought, oh, it's a summer day in Chicago.
Right. I saw you getting coffee downstairs, and I was down there, and you looked like you were like the visual of clammy.
Yeah, if you looked up clammy on the...
It would be you.
It had been a picture of me there. I was a wreck. I wore long sleeves, too, but I thought, damn it, I'm riding my bike. It's
and
a summer day.
You rode your bike in a hot, humid weather situation, and you wore the clothes you're going to wear at work.
Yeah, I didn't plan it out completely. And then, when I got off of work, it was raining really hard.
I thought of you, I know.
I'm like, now what am I going to do?
He thought of you in his car while he drove by.
Air conditioning, yeah.
Actually, I saw you.
Yeah. Hit you with a puddle.
Yeah. Ha ha, sucker!
Right. Today's... I feel clammy now.
Today's a lovely day. Hey, listen, I want to do a shout-out to, it's just kind of fun to watch a local guy do good, and we have been following the exploits of Mick McCaskey, who is the creator of that new potato chip company called Full of Chips, those little bags you get in a vending machine that you might throw in your picnic basket that always run out of chips too quick. Don't you hate that? He has a company called Full of Chips where they fill those little bags with chips. You cannot believe how densely filled of delicious chips they are. And there's just two flavors, barbecue and regular, and they're both dynamite. I've had them both. He's not paying for commercials. It's just fun to watch a guy say, I think I've got a better way. Let's take those bags, and everybody's mad these days that the containers aren't full. You open up your box of cookies or whatever it is, and there's just a lot of air in there. And he said, no, we're going to make potato chips and fill the bags of chips, and the name of the company is Full of Chips. So we just gave him a shout-out the other day, and he sent me an email. He said, John, because of you, Wayne at Big Apple Finer Foods in Chicago and an avid listener just contacted me about an hour ago. I sold him 6 cases.
Nice.
So Big Apple Finer Foods at 2345 North Clark Street, 2345 North Clark Street. Big Apple Finer Foods in Chicago, if you want to get them, you can get them there.
Just think how much he'd sell if he added sour cream and onion.
He said, listen to this, Steve. I've got a top secret, John, bag that I'm working on, something you have never seen before. When I have it, I will share it with you if you want, but give it some time. So maybe he's working on those vinegar and salt chips.
Well, we've seen that before, though. It's got to be something like ice cream flavor or something no one's ever done.
There's a story in the paper today that somebody is coming out with different Chicago-style pizza-flavored chips, which to me is too complicated. Let's just keep it the basic. Salt and pepper, vinegar and oil, or vinegar and salt. You know, the basic flavors.
I mean, once you start...
By that, I mean the ones I like.
I used to know a guy who worked on flavorings.
Yeah, really?
This is a weird thing, but, you know, they're just coming up with chemical compounds that stick to things.
I know.
It's not like it's real spices or, I mean, maybe in some cases it's real spices, but.
No, I think a lot of them are petroleum products and we're ingesting them without a care in the world, and I don't think we should. You can also find Full of Chips at the 7-Eleven in Willowbrook on Joliet Road, at the Citgo in Countryside on 55th. Big Apple Finer Foods on North Clark, and at the Shell stations in Hinsdale and Northlake, among others.
So you do or don't want us to eat those?
Well, I'm sorry, what is the question?
There was a digression into the chemical compounds.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, right.
But then it came back around to, but go ahead and make this purchase.
Interesting segue there, but...
I guess there goes my live endorsement campaign for this guy, huh?
Good thing he's not paying for this.
I know. Oh, I think he'll be just fine. I mean, every now and then, well, first of all, the flavors are regular. That's just regular. That's got to be natural and earthen. And then barbecue, which is made from the barbecue plant. So those are good.
Remember Lay's had a competition called Do Us a Flavor.
Oh, nice.
Where they had people submit their ideas for flavor, potato chip flavors, and then they picked a few and produced them.
Do you know what one? Do you remember?
I don't remember.
Yeah. I really like the salsa, garden salsa flavors.
The sun chips, yeah.
Yeah, right. You know, those are made of natural ingredients.
With salsa, yeah.
I did submit to Do Us a Flavor. I did not win.
What was your flavor?
I was thinking outside the box. I said apples and peanut butter. I don't know.
Seems to me like maybe a thin pool you're swimming in there, Griff.
Hasn't been done before.
No, well, there might be a reason for that. Here is the story from the Washington Post. Now, listen to this. There's a guy named Jerry and a gal named Rita Alter. Jerry and Rita Alter. And they lived in a small New Mexico town called Cliff. They died. They have a son and daughter. Nobody can find them. Their nephew is made the executor of the estate, and he goes in to clean things out. And he does. He sells the sofa and sweeps things out. They're going to liquidate the assets and sell the home. And he pretty much does a sweep, but then he turns it over to an antiques or a dealer guy, and he comes in and buys everything that is left, including a painting on the wall. He pays them $2,000 for everything inside that remains. One of the things that was left inside was a William de Kooning painting that had been missing from the University of Arizona Art Museum 30 years ago. The painting that was hanging on their bedroom wall is valued at $160 million.
Wow.
It's part of a series of paintings, and where do they get that number? One in that series sold in 2006 for just under $120 million, and they say this one's worth $160 million. It was hanging on the bedroom wall in a position where you could only see when you went in and closed the door, and the nephew didn't know about that, and the other guy comes in, and he says, ah, we'll take the painting too, that's a cool mid-century. He then takes it to his furniture and antique store and puts it up on the wall, and he's going to sell it. An hour later, somebody walks in and goes, that's a de Kooning.
Because he lives in an artsy town.
Right. So it's kind of an artsy area. There's a lot of artists in there, and they know about this sort of thing. And so somebody walks in, and they go, I think that's a de Kooning. The next person walks in and goes, that's a de Kooning. It's a real one. The next person walks in and says, that's a de Kooning. It's a real one.
I would have walked in and said, I'll give you $100.
All along the way, Violetta, that does not happen. Think about all the opportunities people had to try and cash in on this, but they didn't. So the guy who runs this shop then goes, holy cow. So what does he do? He puts it in the bathroom for safekeeping. And then he takes it home with him that night, and he stays up all night with it with his guns.
That's my favorite part of the story.
He's got his guns, and he's holding it there going, what if somebody's coming? Oh, I've got $160 million. He doesn't know it, but he knows he's got something. He's got a real de Kooning.
And he knows people are talking about it.
$2,000 you paid for this. It's hanging up in his store. And then it's there at the Manzanita Ridge Furniture and Antique Shop when somebody comes in and goes, you better be careful with that. So he rolls it up. He takes it home. He calls the University of Arizona and says, I think I have something that you guys are missing. And a day later, they show up. When the woman who is the curator of that exhibit at the museum walks in, she falls silent and drops to her knees and says, oh, my God.
Did you say that the frame had stayed empty for 16 years at the museum?
The whole time, as a reminder of what had happened, the museum left the frame on the wall. The thieves had cut it out of the frame. They rolled it up, and somehow or another, it ended up at Jack and Rita's house in Cliff, New Mexico.
So, I'm sorry, I may have missed this part, but they... Were they the thieves that took it out of the museum, do they think?
The FBI thinks... The FBI doesn't know.
Yeah.
But they can't find the kids.
Yeah, that's kind of weird. We're the son and daughter.
Well, one is said was frequently institutionalized. The son, I think.
Well, I think I'll get to that point here, Steve. Yeah. But I think it was actually... Okay, the Adlers had two children, Joseph and Barbara. Reporters from multiple news outlets, including the Washington Post, had been unable to locate them. Several of the couple's acquaintances told the Times that Joseph Adler, the son, had severe psychological problems. He's been institutionalized, yeah. So his whereabouts aren't known, the daughter's whereabouts aren't known, and the nephew said, oh, my God, we've got something here. Here's another funny thing about this couple that may or may not have stolen the painting, but probably did, because they were in Arizona when the painting went missing. And the description of the couple that probably stole it matched the description of the two.
They kept journals of what they ate and how they took their medicine every day, but the day the painting was stolen is left blank altogether.
People saw a car leave the museum that day that matched a car that they happened to own back then. There's a photograph of them in town the day that the painting went missing. But if you sold a $160 million painting, and you've often wondered this, maybe when people buy it, what do they do with it? Do they put it on the wall and just admire it? I mean, what is that? I don't understand that impulse.
So it was in their bedroom, but the other weird thing is they traveled the world.
They were to 140 different countries.
They both had pretty basic jobs.
One was a teacher, one was a speech pathologist at a local school district.
And yet they could afford to do all that traveling.
They had over $1 million in the bank when they died. But how, where'd they get that money? Because they never sold the painting.
Well, you're assuming they only stole one painting or only did one thing.
There you go.
Where they, as like a secret museum they were running in their house. You can come look at the... But that doesn't seem very profitable now.
True.
The more I think about that, it doesn't...
There's a lot of holes in
that. Would you like to see my etchings? That doesn't work, Griffin.
It's not a great idea.
And okay, by the way, that's a de Kooning, but don't tell anybody.
And he was a children's author.
So he writes a book, and it wasn't a great book, but one of the stories in the book is about a couple, a mother and a daughter. That I think it's a parent and a child, and they go to a museum and they steal a gem, and the description of that theft matches the description of the painting.
Wow!
Except instead of a husband and wife, it's a child and a parent, and instead of a painting, it's an emerald.
When the painting was stolen, one of them, I think the wife was talking to the guard, chatting up the guard.
Distracts him.
In the kid's story, I think the daughter was chatting up the guard while the grandmother stole the gem.
So they did it for research. It was just...
No, they wrote it afterwards.
They wrote it afterwards.
So he was kind of like, it was a cry for arrest. Yeah.
Are you saying that the theft was the research for the...
Yeah, you had to get inside the head of the character. You got to do it.
That's suffering for your craft. Now, isn't it? Okay, we may go to jail, but I really think we need to go...
I got to get it right.
So the FBI to this day does not know. I mean, so it appears that this late couple stole it.
Wait, how does the story end? This is the worst kid story ever to steal something.
Yeah, I don't know. Oh, yeah. Get a load of this. Here's how the children's story ends. in the children's story, the guard realizes that the gem is missing. So he goes running out to chase the thieves, the parent and the child. And as they drive away, they turn the car around, run over, and kill the guard.
No.
And that way, nobody will ever know who did it. Now, while that did not happen in real life, in each case, nobody knows who did it. That's the story of Jerry and Rita Alter and the small town of Cliff, New Mexico, where the William de Kooning story, a painting, was found.
That's just a wild story.
Isn't that
crazy?
Isn't that fun? And again, and I don't know, maybe this is a small point to you all, but imagine that. You've committed, you have $160 million of contraband on the wall, which you could try and cash in. Or you have $160 million of contraband on the wall, which you stole. How do you live with yourself? And does it bring you so much joy to gaze at it in your bedroom with the door closed that that it's worth it to you? That's, I don't understand that.
That's so true. Like, so I would suffer immense guilt anyway. And then if I put it in a place where I looked at it every night and was reminded, one, that I did it, but even more strongly, that I could get busted for doing it.
Right, you know, how do you go to sleep staring at it?
Yeah, and you do. And so here's the age-old, and what do people always say in a story like this? They interview the neighbor, and they say they were a quiet couple. I never thought they would do something like this. And their friends and family say just that. And that is the story. We're talking about a piece that's in the Washington Post about Jerry and Rita Alter. Hey, I've got tickets to see Thomas Jefferson. You want to go to the show? It's going to be Saturday, August 18th at the College of DuPage. I'm looking at my friend Marlene Wells. She's the lady that organizes all of these things. And she's got a couple of tickets for you for the 1 o'clock show. Thomas Jefferson's on stage. I talked to him a little bit. You get to ask questions, too. The title of this year's show is Thanks, Thomas Jefferson. We needed that, and we do. Some good humor and some wisdom from one of our founding fathers. Come to this show. Buy tickets right now at WGNradio.com/events, or you can win them if you're the 10th caller. At, what's the phone number here, Griffin? 312-981-7200.
High fly ball, deep left center field, going back to the warning track, defense and jumping. Engel makes the grab! Grabs him of a home run! Back-to-back nights for Adam Engel, taking away a home run from a Yankees batter.
You can still get tickets to the game. Roanna, you guys, Kevin, no, you guys should go to the game tonight.
I was there last night when that happened.
Oh, no, and I saw the one the night before.
Yeah. I went the night before, too.
It was fun because I walked up into the booth with Ed and DJ right after it happened.
Yeah.
All right, so you want me to tell you the honest-to-God truth of what happened? I was in the bathroom when it occurred, and I heard the call. And then I go up, and I was up there. We took the fine David and Kristen Berryhill from Archideck of Chicagoland.
Lovely people.
With us, we gave away the deck yesterday, and we went to the game last night. I took them up to the broadcast booth so they could meet Ed and DJ. And in the commercial break, DJ turns and goes, "How about that?" He goes, "How about that?" And I'm like, "Yeah, it was really great. It wasn't great to see." I go, "I was in the bathroom listening to your call."
Yeah.
Oh, gee. Did you wash your hands, or were you in such a rush to get
No, I just rushed right out. I rushed right out and screamed in the concourse.
I could see that.
Yeah. No, it's great. It's great. It is. You could tell. I will say this. You could tell that they're on the precipice of something over there.
You see things every now and then, and you go, 2 years, 1.5 years.
Yeah.
We have the building blocks.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me tell you, next month, you're going to see guys come up. Everybody's talking about Eloy Jimenez coming up. They're talking about Luis Robert coming up, Kopech, and all these guys that have been in the farm system that will probably be here for most of next season. But you'll see them in September. And it's so reminiscent of what the Cubs were doing. First of all, half these guys are former Cubs farm team guys, right?
I want them to be, but I'm kind of curious, and I'm out of my league now, but remember how the Cubs timed Chris Bryant's arrival so that they didn't have to pay him for the year and they got him on the back end for another year?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm wondering if they bring these guys up now, then don't we lose
the
year
September
on the back
end? No.
Yeah, it does. It goes to service time. That's why one of the reasons people think they're not going to bring him up.
That's what I heard.
You push back the service time clock, and you get basically you prolong free agency for them for an extra year. So you get an extra year of.
So what's the point of bringing them up now? Because
they're ready.
Gate.
Yeah,
that's the reason to bring them up.
Because they're ready. Yeah,
but I would rather take my lumps and suffer at the gate this year if I could have them for another year when the team's competitive.
Yeah, but you just take them out of the first couple of weeks of next year, and then you bring them up. It's service time before you activate them as well, major leaguers,
once,
right?
Well, once they're on the major league roster, the clock starts. So, you know, they...
Even into September?
Yes, even
okay.
In September.
All right. You are the expert, Kevin Powell. All right, I guess we got to keep him down there then. Why did we do that?
I think you should bring up at least Eloy for sure.
Right.
He's ready.
He'd be exciting to watch.
You figure he's going to go from spring training right...
To the Hall of Fame?
right to Chicago, right? It's not going to be... It's the opening day. It's not going to be one of those things where they're going to send back down to Charlotte.
Right. Yeah, once you bring them up, you're going to leave them up,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, yeah.
I got to get out of your way, guys. All that baseball talk. Ro, what's the highlight? What's the headline of your show today?
Very fun. Let me just tell you something, John. There's always something. A.B. Stoddard will be joining us coming up in a few minutes. How about the congressman who now has been charged with insider trading after he called his son to dump stock in a company that he knew was going under? Because they found something that, you know, the government didn't okay something for them. So they knew the stock was going under before the market found out. He called his son, to dump the stock.
Yeah.
Are you thinking, all right, well, that's okay. Why is that such a big deal? Because he called him from the White House.
Oh, gee.
Oh, no.
that's why.
Not okay.
It's a big deal. We'll, talk about that and all the other stuff that's fit to print. And the president ever going to meet with Bob Mueller?
How does he get to decide? When I get to be king, the guy or his attorney don't get to decide.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. Right. Technically, you don't. But you know, I like the way Rudy, you know, we're not going to do it. Okay. Oh, you know what? That's right. And I was saying this earlier. It's like if our own Mike Monaco, who is our own Rudy Giuliani,
right,
just said, Ro Khan did not run that red light. Why are you charging with this? It just didn't happen. Let's just drop this. And then you go, oh, okay. Well, my lawyer says I didn't do it. Okay.
Right, and they're also setting a deadline. He should be done with it by September 1st. Yeah. It should be over.
Okay.
Have a good show, Ro.
All right, thank you. It's too late now.